It's time for a special edition of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us. This is Michael Brown. I am right now in Washington, D.C., attending a world summit on the persecuted church sponsored by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. In fact, we had a surprise speaker this morning. Really didn't know anyone who was going to be speaking in advance. We knew that Franklin Graham would be there and be involved, but didn't know anyone in particular who's going to be speaking. But it's definitely a surprise when on Wednesday night, the beginning of the conference, they announced that Vice President Pence would be speaking this morning. So that was earlier this morning, an important message of solidarity with the persecuted church. I will not be taking calls. I know you're ready with your Jewish questions, ready to ask. Sorry, I won't be taking your calls today, but I do want to cover a lot of ground. Do you want to talk about President Trump's visit to Israel? Do you want to talk about some relevant things in terms of the church in the midst of persecution that relate to Israel, that relate to the Middle East? So we're going to talk about that as well. A lot of things to share. But first, on the lighter side, I had mentioned earlier in the week that a Palestinian terrorist serving multiple life sentences in an Israeli prison has been leading a hunger strike. And Israel, who's monitoring his prison cell, posted a little video montage where he's seen eating. This is during the hunger strike. Now, no one's saying it's easy to fast, especially when you're just in a prison cell with nothing to do and nowhere to go. But when you're leading a hunger strike, obviously you don't want to be eating. So the footage shows kind of a stash by his bed and, you know, hidden under his bed. And at one point he takes out a candy bar and eats it. And another point takes out some cookies and eats them. So Pizza Hut Israel has gotten in a little trouble with Pizza Hut International, with the main company. What they did is they posted some pictures of this video of him eating. Was it on social media in Israel or ad? I forget exactly how it was put out, but this was just this week. And the Pizza Hut shows him eating cookies, eating a candy bar, and then asks, wouldn't pizza be better? So this is Israel's way of dealing with this issue of a hunger striker eating in the name of Palestinian liberation. Well, so much for that. So President Trump making his first major international trip now, going to Israel, which is very important and does send a message. But word is out that he has decided that he will not be relocating the embassy to Jerusalem. Now, there are others say, no, that's not accurate. And Israel claims it has no such notification of that. Now, when President Trump was asked about this a couple of weeks back with reference to the trip he was going to be making, he said, ask me in a month, you know, are you going to be moving the embassy or not? Obviously, President Trump, with a flair for drama, could go to Israel and announce, yes, we're relocating the embassy as promised. The ambassador that he appointed to Israel, David Friedman, is certainly in favor of that. And Donald Trump said he was going to do it to the point that people were rattled over it and upset over it because every president talks about it, but nobody does it. Will he be, in this case, once again, talk but no action like previous presidents, or will he actually do it? We shall see, but I've got more to say on that, the importance of it, and the question of, is it worth the risk? This is Michael Brown. You're listening to a special edition of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We're great.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown here. I won't be taking your calls today. I am reporting from a world summit on persecuted Christians in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. Because of that, I won't be taking your calls, but we want to be as up to the minute as we can here on the broadcast. Do you know that Billy Graham is now 98 and a half years old? And what Franklin shared was that when Billy Graham was 90, that he told his family he was going to be, he's going to live to be 95, and no one thought he would be. And you know, he's been sick with one thing or another for many years. And sure enough, he made it to 95. So now he's saying he's going to make it to 100. And obviously with a bit of a smile there. In any case, what a legacy. What an important ministry. All right. President Trump's visit to Israel is obviously major. He doesn't have to take the trip. It's not like there's a summit taking place, a world summit with different nations, and he's there for that. So it's sending a message by saying on this first major overseas trip, he's going to Israel. But what exactly is going to happen? Now, during his campaign, he emphatically stated that we were going to relocate the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Remember the situation in Israel, that different nations that have diplomatic relationships with Israel have their embassies in Tel Aviv rather than in Jerusalem. It's considered too controversial to have them in Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So every other nation around the world, whatever country says this is our capital, America, it's Washington, D.C., whatever the capital is of any country, that's where the embassies are, except in Israel. You say, well, why haven't we moved our embassy there? Was it something Obama did? No, no, don't blame President Obama. Don't blame President Bush. Don't blame President Clinton, or blame all of them, meaning that a resolution was passed while President Clinton was in office saying that we would move the embassy to Jerusalem. And then a period of time goes by and you say, well, we're not going to do it yet, but we'll just renew it. It's like pressing the snooze button. Well, the next time the snooze button has to be pressed is June, right? So right around the corner. Well, President Trump was so strong on this. He was not going to do what President Obama did. He was not going to do what President Bush did. He was not going to do what President Clinton did. He was so strong on this that it rattled some people. I remember one news commenter that I referenced on the air where he said, look, everybody talks about it, but nobody's actually going to do it. Well, Donald Trump said he's going to do it. And then he appoints David Friedman as our ambassador to Israel, and David Friedman is very strong on the embassy being relocated. Now, you have to understand, you don't need to build a building, okay? And we're talking right now, West Jerusalem, which is supposedly the undisputed part of Jerusalem, because the Palestinians say they want East Jerusalem to be their capital, but you can put the embassy in West Jerusalem. You can take an existing building there that America owns and government owns, say, okay, this is the embassy here. It's that simple to do, theoretically. Why wouldn't it be done? Is Donald Trump not a true friend of Israel? I believe he is. I believe he's a true friend of Israel. And I feel better about his stand with Israel than I did about President Obama's stand with Israel. That was notoriously weak. And Israelis, by and large, did not feel good about President Obama's stance towards Israel. They felt better about President Bush's stance, although both President Bush and President Obama wanted to see a two-state solution. So President Trump, I do believe he's a friend of Israel. I don't believe charges that he's anti-Semitic. Don't believe that for a split second. But is he just a big talker? Did he use all kinds of rhetoric in his campaign? You say, well, every politician does. All right, well, he was not going to be like every other politician. So his talk was strong enough that I thought he might well do it. I think he'll do it. Now, why wouldn't he do it? Well, why unnecessarily disrupt the Muslim world? We're not trying to appease ISIS or trying to appease Hamas, but we're talking about, why get the president of Egypt upset? Why get other Muslim and Arabic leaders upset that we have a good working relationship with? Why provoke them? So perhaps it's not wise. Perhaps it's not worth it. I've even read from some pro-Israel people, that's not worth it. It's going to flare up. It's going to cause too many problems to flare up. And on top of that, it could risk the lives of Israelis, because certainly this is going to be used for anti-Israel propaganda. Certainly this is going to stir up more hatred towards Israel. Certainly there's going to be yet another intifada, and Jewish blood will be shed, women, children, and men. So why provoke it? That's some of the argument against it, and maybe even terrorist attacks against Americans. That's serious, and that should be taken seriously, because we're talking about casualties. We're talking about human beings being cut down because of a political decision. On the flip side, I believe there are very strong, ample, and good reasons to do it. After all, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Why, pray tell, allow for every other nation on the planet to say where its capital is, and yet you don't have your embassy there? That's an affront. And Israel's only capital for millennia, the city that was the city of the Jewish people, the city where they long to return to, where they religious Jews pray facing every day, and the one recognized capital of the nation through the centuries is Jerusalem. And isn't it about time to tell the terrorists, we're not going to bow down to you? Israel can double down on its security and do its best to prevent further terrorist attacks. And America can tell allies, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Egypt, whether it's another Muslim country with whom we have good relations, we can tell them, look, this is the way it is. It is the capital. And we're not even talking about divided Jerusalem, or will East Jerusalem be a capital of a Palestinian state? We're not talking about any of that. If East Jerusalem, think of this, if East Jerusalem is supposed to be the capital of a Palestinian state, are you telling me then that people, other countries, would not then put their embassies in East Jerusalem because that's the capital of a Palestinian state? Well, how do they do it for Palestinians and not for Israel? So this is not even a statement as to whether there'll be a two-state solution or not. It's simply recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and I personally believe that America should do it. And President Trump is going to need some very clear reasons why he can't, because of the strength of what he said campaigning. Again, I understand politicians make promises. Some they can't keep. Some they simply don't keep. Sometimes the realities on the ground are different than they expect. Sometimes they realize they got to compromise more. But when you run the way candidate Trump ran and made the statements you made, and he has every legal right to do this, to not do it to me would be a real letdown and betrayal. So there was a report on the Hebrew language news site NRG that implied Israeli sources were notified that Trump had decided against moving the embassy and would sign a waiver in June blocking implementation of a longstanding congressional mandate ordering the relocation. This is as reported by Eric Cortalesa on the Times of Israel website. So the Israeli government says, no, we have no such notification. We were not told that the president had decided that he was not going to move the embassy. And then Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters at the daily press briefing yesterday, Wednesday, quote, the president has not made a decision yet and is still reviewing that. And was it last week or the week before, Vice President Pence said the same thing. Now, as to the idea that President Trump would use his visit to Israel, this is going to be May 22nd, 23rd, he'll be there, that he's going to use his visit to Israel to announce the relocation of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, that would be high drama, and I, for one, would be pleased to see it. No, don't trash your relationship with with Muslim nations, but basically say, look, you're just going to have to accept this is the capital. That's the reality. And that's where our embassy belongs. All right, friends, we are just getting started on the special edition of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We come back, I want to talk to you about something very moving, very touching I heard from a Coptic Christian last night at the World Summit for Persecuted Christians. This is a special by invitation only event being hosted by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. By the way, speaking of Jewish ministry on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and Jewish things, do you have my mini book, the free ebook, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah? No? Here's how you get it. Go to AskDrBrown.org today. Sign up for our e-list, and the ebook is yours. It's a real eye-opener. Our gift to you.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to this special edition of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown coming away from Washington, D.C. I'm not taking calls today on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but I have to say, the last few Thursdays, we've had some really, really important calls, some excellent calls. Calls where I was really able to interact at some length with callers who had different perspectives, which I really appreciate being able to do. So if you're listening and you're one of those who differs with me and you were all ready to call today, well, God willing, next week, next Thursday on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, if it's Jewish related, by all means, give me a call. All right, a few things I want to share in terms of reaching out with the good news of Jesus to Jewish people. On the one hand, as a Jew, I have an advantage of speaking to my own people because I'm one of them. I'm a Jew as well, and it's harder for them to say, well, Jews don't believe in Jesus, because, well, here's one sitting next to you who does. So it's an advantage I have in that regard, where just like if you're of a particular culture or background, ethnicity, skin color, come from religious background, whatever, if you have certain commonality with a certain person, that's very helpful. Maybe you came out of Catholicism and became a born-again believer in Jesus. Maybe you came out of a dead Protestant tradition and came to really know the Lord, and you're talking to someone with a similar background. Well, that's always very helpful. And obviously, since there's this deep sense of betrayal, there's this deep sense of betrayal where I can't betray my ancestors and they didn't believe in this Jesus. Why should I? It's a foreign religion. Say, no, I'm more attached to my people than I've ever been. I wouldn't have learned Hebrew if not for Yeshua. I would have sought to be some rock drummer. And who knows if, you know, that didn't pan. Well, I probably wouldn't live that long if I didn't come to know the Lord. But, you know, the love that I have for Israel, the burden I have to share the pain that Israel's experienced through history with the church, these things have all come because I'm a born-again follower of Jesus. But on the flip side, many times it is Gentile Christians who are not of Jewish descent, who have an opportunity to share with Jewish people, because it's okay for that Gentile to believe in Jesus. That's fine for you. And they can almost put their defenses down in that regard, because, yeah, you're a Gentile. It's fine if you believe in Jesus. We have no problem with that as Jews. And if he's helpful to you and brings you closer to God and helps you live a moral life, well, great, more power to you. And you might have more of an open door to share, because you're not viewed as if you're a traitor. You're not looked at as if you're a traitor or a blasphemer. And that's how traditional Jews, many of them, would look at me. And, okay, you're not expected to keep the seventh-day Sabbath according to Jewish tradition. But a religious Jew would look at me and say, well, do you do it? Well, not according to Jewish tradition. I do set it aside as a day of rest if I'm not out speaking and ministering, which would be the equivalent of the priest working in the temple on the Sabbath, doing priestly ministry on the Sabbath. So if I'm not preaching or ministering on the Sabbath, on Saturday, then I set that aside just to rest. It doesn't mean if I'm burdened to write that I won't write, But traditional Jews would say, well, if you write several letters together, then that's work. That's considered work. And now you'd study for hours and hours. That's not work. But if you write, that's work. So no, I don't keep the Sabbath according to Jewish tradition, or in the same way a religious Jew would, and in the same way of a command with a penalty if I don't. No, I don't keep it in that regard. I do it in a way set apart before the Lord, but not the way Jewish tradition would. So I'm looked at as a bad guy, as an outsider, as a traitor. And because I'm trying to win other Jews to Jesus, I'm the worst of all. I'm not just a sinner, but I'm leading others into sin. That's the way they would see it. As one rabbi said decades ago, as we were having a friendly debate, he said, I'm not just a chote, but a machti, not just a sinner, but one causing others to sin. That's how I'd be viewed. But you as a Gentile Christian, your Jewish friend, religious Jew, he's not expecting you to keep the seventh-day Sabbath, and he's certainly not expecting you to keep it according to Jewish tradition. So you might actually have an open door to share the gospel that I wouldn't have. Now let me give you a case in point. So I speak with this ultra-Orthodox Jewish man on a Thursday, a couple Thursdays ago, and we begin to have, I call him afterwards, and he's calling to reach out to me and to set me straight. And if I just will study with him one time, my life will be changed. I said, great, let's do it. We'll study over the phone together. Great. And so I call him. He leaves his number with our studio. I call him the same day. We talk for 45 minutes. He raises a particular point, and I said, but that's a misinterpretation of the scripture. And then that leads to email dialogue between us, after which time he cut me off. No more dialogue with me. Basically saying questions are fine, but you have to keep the commandments, pretty much as taught by the rabbis, while you have your questions. Otherwise, you're an apostate. Well, hang on. If you have questions, if I don't agree with the rabbinic interpretation of the text, why would I keep the laws according to the rabbis while I look for my questions to be answered? That's like me telling you, maybe you come from a charismatic background and used to speak in tongues, and now you don't think it's God anymore. And I said, well, at least while you're wondering about it, keep praying in tongues an hour a day. It's like, well, why would I if I don't think it's real? Or if you were once an atheist and now for the first time you're starting to read the Bible, but you have a million questions about it. And I said, well, you got to live by it while you have your questions. It's like, well, why would I live by it if I'm not sure if it's real or not? So the point is, I was this dangerous outsider because although I'm a Jew, I was not living by our traditions. And in his mind as a Jew, I have to, even while I have questions. All right. Well, you as a Gentile Christian, he's not expecting that. In other words, you are a person of another religion. Now, yes, you want him to see that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. Yes, you want him to see that he is the one promised to Israel. He's the one of whom Moses and the prophets spoke. The New Testament writings constantly are referring back to what's written in the Hebrew scriptures and saying this came to fulfill what was written over and over and over and over and over and over again. There's no question about that. There's no ambiguity about that. But for the religious Jew, you're from another religion, talking to him about believing in another religion, but you might actually have an open door because you won't be immediately written off. And maybe he'll see something in you that is beautiful and precious and holy that he wouldn't be able to see in me, or that she wouldn't be able to see in me, because I'd be expected to be living by the traditions. Does that make sense to you? In any case, the great majority of Jews in America, even worldwide, especially outside of Israel, but in America, are not religious. You probably know the Bible better than they do, the average Jew that you speak with. You probably know the Bible better than they do, in which case, not only do you have a relationship with God and forgiveness of sins and a transformed life, but you know the Bible better as well. So don't be hesitant to share the gospel if the door is open and the relationship permits it. Most Jews in America that come to faith probably do so through the witness of a Christian friend.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. I'm delighted to be with you. This is a special edition of the broadcast right now. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I'm attending a special conference, an invitation-only private conference on persecuted church worldwide. The reason I state it like that is because you might have said, oh, I would have loved to be there if I knew about it. Representatives have come in from different nations, relatives of some of the Coptic Christians who were beheaded by ISIS, one of the more atrocious videos that they sent out last year. Some of the relatives of the martyrs are here, and just some incredible godly people in the midst of suffering. So I'm not doing my normal call-in show today as I'm in Washington, D.C., but a lot to share with you. So God willing, we'll resume with your Jewish calls next week. As I say that, my habit is to give out the phone number, but I'm not going to do it. Let me mention a couple things of interest that have come up already in this conference, and then I'll get back to a more specifically Jewish focus in a moment. A number of people have come up to me, some from other countries, some from the States, but what we all have in common is our concern for persecuted Christians. Some of the folks speaking to me, their full-time ministry and their full-time job is serving the suffering church. And you know what some of these leaders have said to me? Thank you so much for the stance you're taking on cultural issues and gay activism. And thanks for doing it with love and truth together. You say, what, are you just patting yourself on the back? No. That's not why I share this. That's not why I share it. I share it to say that these issues matter. I share it to say that these are concerns carried by Christians in other countries as well. I share it to say it's not either or. It is both and. And yes, I want to do more and more to help my suffering brothers and sisters in different parts of the world. And yes, we have grads from our ministry school serving in dangerous parts of the world. And yes, one of our grads was martyred by Islamic terrorists about 5 years ago. Yes, all that is true. But the suffering is so great, and I feel on a certain level there's so much more I could do to raise my voice or help or stand together, and I really hope to do that more and more in the years ahead. These have always been burdens I've carried, and for some time there was a custom in my home congregation where every week we would pray for one of three subjects congregationally, either revival in the church regionally and nationally, or praying for the salvation of Israel, or praying for the persecuted church. It was something that was always on our hearts, and hopefully we can do more, we can pray more, we can carry the burden more, and we can live more boldly. But all that to say, at a conference on the suffering church, people have not said, you know, why are you wasting your time on these social issues when the church is suffering around the world? Christians in countries where there's persecution have come and thanked me for addressing cultural issues. So I just say that to say these things matter. Yes, people matter. Yes. The people want to reach out to matter. But these are issues of concern, and I address them because the Lord has burdened me to address them. I address them because I care. I address them because I want to honor the Lord and do what's right. So again, I'm not saying it to toot my own horn. Please, please don't take it like that. I'm not saying it in a self-congratulatory way. I'm not saying it to say I'm vindicated. I'm simply saying people care and people need our voice. So let's stand together and make a difference. We'll be right back.
It's It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Line of Fire. This is your thoroughly Jewish host, Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. I'm not taking calls today. I'm attending a conference on the persecuted church in Washington, D.C. God willing, if you've got a Jewish-related question, next Thursday we'll be taking your calls once again. Okay, one of the great stories that I heard at this conference, and this was last night, Wednesday night, a leader from the Coptic Church in Egypt was there, and he talked about speaking to a mother who lost two sons. Two of her Coptic Christian sons were slaughtered by radical Muslims, all right? And she has forgiven them and prays that they will really come to know the Lord. How do you explain something like that? How do you explain that quality of life outside of Jesus working in someone? Oh, I imagine other people have found ways to forgive outside of the Lord, but I'm telling you, this is so powerful that you see it so frequently among Christians who have suffered. It's really remarkable. Also, I found out something very interesting I'd never known before. There were 21 Christians who were slaughtered by ISIS terrorists last year, beheaded, again, sent out by video for the world to see. What I didn't know was that one of the men who was beheaded had not been a Christian before. He had not been a believer. But when he saw the devotion of these Christians to the Lord, when he saw the quality of their faith and the strength of their life in God, that when they asked him his beliefs, he said, "Their God is my God," and professed faith in the Lord, because of which he was beheaded. So think of this. Think of this. You're not a believer, all right? You walk away scot-free with your head on your shoulders. You walk away a free person simply by holding on to your non-belief. We're not talking about a Christian denying the Lord. We're not talking about a believer going back on his or her faith. We're talking about someone who's not a believer and maybe is impressed, while these Christians are amazing, but they're about to be killed. They're about to be beheaded. I mean, you're talking about a horrific death and death, period. Your life's going to be cut short right there. You're a young man, probably with family. But he was so impressed by the faith of the Christians that moved him to say, "Their God is my God." And he was beheaded. How utterly remarkable. So I spent some time over dinner last night with two Arabic Christians. One has been on our radio show before, Reverend Stephen Khoury, a pastor in Jerusalem, and another brother who was from Gaza originally and now lives in Bethlehem, and he is also an Arabic Christian. And we were discussing things about the state of the church in Gaza, the state of the church in Gaza. And he said it used to be about 3,000 strong, but now it's down to about 500, obviously because of Hamas. If Israel was in control of Gaza, the church of Gaza, believers in Gaza, would be able to worship freely and serve God freely and preach the gospel freely. However, with Israel not in control and Hamas in control, Hamas is worse than Palestinian Authority, that means that there is not going to be real religious liberty for the Christians there. And of course, it would be illegal for a Muslim to convert. And if a family member went to kill a Muslim convert, law is either going to sanction it or just look the other way. Go ahead. That's an honor killing and that's legitimate. Now, interestingly, and to the glory of God, I heard a story some years back about a Palestinian Muslim whose son, adult son, became a Christian. And because of his son becoming a Christian, the father was going to poison him. So they had the son over for a meal. Think of this. He's your own son. But because he's committed the ultimate sin of apostatizing, joining another religion, I mean, what could be worse than that, right? So the father, it was a sacred duty to kill his son. So he poisoned him, put a large amount of poison in his meal. And when the son ate the meal and was completely untouched, unaffected, the son had no idea, that's why he was there at the family's house eating, that the father became a Christian. But in any case, we were talking about one of the problems that Christians in Israel sometimes face. And we're talking about, say, that are under Palestinian Authority, maybe living in Bethlehem. And it is a victim mentality. This is what this one pastor was sharing with me, who is from Gaza originally. A victim mentality, look at all the bad things Israel has done to us. Look at how they've taken our land. Look at how they're keeping us down. And rather than having the mentality of overcomers that believers often have in the midst of difficult situations, even if Israel was guilty, of course, I differ with their narrative, but these are their lies, and I understand where they're coming from, all right? But even if Israel was guilty, you don't gain ground spiritually by having a victim mentality. Now, this is something I've heard from other believers, but it was interesting coming from the lips of an Arab Christian who's trying to speak that to his colleagues. Now, I'm not saying throughout the Middle East. I'm saying living in Israel, this is now the official narrative by which you say, I'm the victim. Look at what evil Israel has done, rather than saying, Father, forgive them. Rather than having that attitude. And this is not universal, but it's for many. When you talk to believers suffering in other countries, they know the world is against them, they know their country is against them, and many of them have this supernatural grace and joy and ministry of an overcomer. And yet that can be lacking when we have the victimhood mentality. Just think of it in the natural. And this is something I've often talked about. You know, nobody owes you a free lunch. It's part of my book, Saving a Sick America, that'll be out in September, about the entitlement mentality and how deadly that is and how we have to overcome that. But the bottom line here is that if I think, for example, I'm on a sports team, and well, they don't like me because they don't like the color of my skin, or they don't like me because they don't like my ethnicity, or they don't like me because I come from a wealthy family. I'm a part of the inner click here or something. I'm going to walk around with a bad attitude. Yeah, go ahead, cut me off the team. That's probably next. I'm going to get fired. If my attitude was, man, nobody here likes me, but I'm going to make this team. Nobody here likes me. I'm going to take that as an incentive to do even better. And so that the whole team wants me on the team. You see how the attitudes are different. And in order to gain the sympathy of Christians who often side with Israel, there has to be this woe is me kind of mentality. Again, this is what this Arab Christian was sharing, and I've seen it to be true as well. Now, here's, again, not universally, and they're fine Christians that live in Israel, that live under the Palestinian Authority, and that have issues with Israel, and that look at Israel as an occupier. I understand that. I'm simply saying that there's a problem with the mentality that many of them have. And this was to me from an Arab Christian. Pastor Corey and I were talking about replacement theology. And I said, is it accurate to say that there are some Palestinian Christians who have a problem with the Old Testament? He said, yes. Why? Because God gives all these promises to Israel, 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 Israel. God gives the land to Israel, Israel, Israel. There's even the conquest of the Canaanites. Well, they read Israel, that's my neighbor that's oppressing me. That's my neighbor that stole my land. That's my neighbor that's occupying my country. That's my neighbor that put up a wall and deprive me of rights. That's how they're reading it. It's very difficult for them to see past that, but some do. Because of which they have a supernatural love for the Jewish people and a recognition of, hey, this is the land that God gave you. We'd like to live side by side with you, so welcome us, but this is the land that God gave you, and we affirm that. It's just very interesting to see these dynamics work out. And you have to have compassion for those who've been raised in a certain environment where Israel is so demonized and where some of their own experiences have reinforced that demonization of Israel. And yet God's choosing of Israel is not because of Israel's goodness and not because of Israel's kindness and not because of Israel's moral superiority. Yes, there are many wonderful qualities about Israel, and there are many things that cause Israel to stand out in the Middle East. And if you ask your average Palestinian, would you rather be under Israeli government or Palestinian government, you'd be surprised how many say Israeli government because they know they have freedoms there. Nonetheless, you're raised in a certain environment. You see things through a certain lens. Sometimes it takes the grace and love of God to overcome it. And I love when I see supernatural reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians through the cross of the Messiah, through the blood of Yeshua. All right, more to come on the special edition of Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we have one more segment to go. I'm looking at about three different things I want to get into. This is Michael Brown. You're listening to the Line of Fire broadcast on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, a special broadcast as I'm coming your way from Washington, D.C., not taking calls today on this Thursday, May 11th. Yeah, just looking at the calendar, I lose track of days. So let me give another side of the story. There are religious Jews who read the injunction in Leviticus 19, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and they say that neighbor is a fellow Jew, that you don't have to love the Palestinian, the Arab, the non-believer, the non-Jew, the same way that you love a fellow Jew. And obviously, that's a misreading of the text. And Yeshua even challenges that type of misreading in Luke 10 with the parable of the Good Samaritan, which he concludes with, well, you go be the neighbor. You go be the neighbor to the person that may be different than you. You go be the neighbor to the outsider. You go be the neighbor to the person in need. So there are certainly attitudes among some in Israel that would cultivate negativity towards Palestinians. I want to make the general statement that to the extent Israel is in control and running and leading the territories that it, quote, occupies, to that extent, be it Gaza, which is now pulled out of, or be it the West Bank, historic Judea and Samaria, to the extent that Israel leads those, runs those, it's best for the Palestinians, meaning they'll have better quality of life, they'll have better education, they'll have more rights and things like that. There'd just be more positive things that would come out of it in general. To the extent it is going to be run by Islamic and even radical Islamic leadership, it's going to be negative for the people. That being said, does not mean that every Israeli has the right attitude. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that all Israelis have a spirit of love for their Palestinian neighbors. And there are some that serve in the military, and it upsets them. They feel that the Palestinians are mistreated or dehumanized or things like that. And they may be very left-wing and oppose Israel's treatment. So yeah, there are different sides to this. The ultra-Orthodox, called the Haredi, Haredim, in the book of Isaiah, those that shake and quiver before God. They are God-fearers, but it's just colloquial for ultra-Orthodox Jews. Here's a report in the Jerusalem Post. Haredi school books promote isolation. Suspicion of outside world, says NGO. This is 2 days ago, May 9th, in the Jerusalem Post, reported by Jeremy Sharon. And let me just scroll down here. A comprehensive study by the education watchdog organization Impact says this. Impact S-SC, is that right? That there... No, sorry, I think it's just a typo here. A comprehensive study by the Education Watch Organization Impact of textbooks used in Haredi, which is ultra-Orthodox schools, has found that they teach a worldview that is isolationist, contemptuous of secular society, and instills hatred of Reform Jews, who are very liberal Jews, left-wing Jews. They would ordain, say, a lesbian to be a rabbi, so ordaining a woman, let alone a lesbian woman, to be a rabbi is completely anathema to them. Reform Jews would say the commandments are for guidance, not for governance. In other words, you work out how you keep these in your own life. It's not like an absolute that you have to do. Well, that's utterly anathema to religious Jews. And there's some of them who say that they're not really Jews, Reform Jews, or at least what they practice is not Judaism. So that would not surprise me at all. Despite this, the report notes that tolerance and respect toward, quote, the individual other is expressed in Haredi school textbooks, and that respect for the rule of law and a generally pragmatic attitude to the state is encouraged. All right, so that's positive, that there should be tolerance and respect towards the individual other. I guess it is Impact-SE. They examined 93 textbooks used in grades 1 through 12 in the two major educational frameworks in Haredi schools, quote, exempt institutions and recognized but unofficial. The frequently negative attitudes in many of the textbooks toward non-Haredi society gives the perception of danger and suspicion of the outside world. Yeah, that's how it would be viewed. The outside world would be looked at with great hostility, especially the outside Jewish world. These are Jews, and they're supposed to be living by the Torah, the written Torah that was given to Moses, and they believe in oral Torah passed down to Moses and then through the generations and developed through the generations. That's what they believe. So for this Jewish state, which is a secular state, even though it's a Jewish state, it still does not mandate that every Jew has to keep the law. There are not penalties, for example, throughout Israel if you don't observe the Sabbath, or penalties throughout Israel where if you ate leaven during Passover, something like that. No, that doesn't exist. And much of the state is worldly, and there's godlessness and drugs and prostitution and crime and all these kinds of things. So yeah, they will definitely look at the outside world with hostility. There's no question about that. And remember that the education they get is primarily religious education. So they take other subjects because they're required to by the government. But in most cases, if it was up to them, they wouldn't. That's really secondary. That's a waste of time when they can just be learning Jewish traditions all day to which they are devoted. So yes, the attitudes there might ultimately generate hostility for outsiders, especially for outsider Jews, interestingly enough. So I'm not trying to paint a picture of Israel as a perfect nation and their attitudes within Israel that are destructive and harmful, and attitudes among the Palestinians that are destructive and harmful. Hey, friends, there's a great tool I want to put in your hands, and it is Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. It's an ebook, and it's yours absolutely free. It's my gift to you when you simply sign up for our emails. To sign up for our emails, just go to AskDrBrown.org. AskDrBrown.org. You'll see the box. Sign up there. It'll take you just a few seconds, and we'll get you that free ebook. Also, very exciting announcement. After many, many years of dialogue interaction with ultra-Orthodox rabbi, counter-missionary rabbi Yisrael Blumenthal, we agreed on a format to get our positions out on YouTube and then have time to respond to each other. And God willing, on Monday at noon on our YouTube channel, on our Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel, we will be releasing my presentation on the real Jewish Messiah, 20 minutes long. At the same time, on a YouTube channel that Rabbi Blumenthal will have set up, he will be releasing his presentation. You can listen to them side by side. God willing, 1 month later, we'll both release rebuttals, and then 1 month later, responses to the rebuttals. So you'll have an hour from each of us back and forth. We can evaluate what he says, what I say. If you're a religious Jewish listener, if you're a Messianic Jewish listener, if you're just an interested listener, this is a great opportunity. So stay tuned. We'll be announcing that on Monday, posting it on Facebook and elsewhere. We're out of time. May the blessing of the Lord be yours.